Hello, I'm Steve Holmes. I'm a GP with an interest in respiratory disease, and I work in Somerset. And I'm joined today by Peter Bagshaw, a colleague who also works in Somerset and has an interest in mental health. Welcome to our podcast, which comes to you as part of Chronic Conditions Month 2023, which is taking place throughout May. This includes a whole string of interactive and informative webinars designed to address the primary care challenges of diagnosing and managing chronic conditions across a range of therapeutic areas. Today, in this podcast, we're going to be discussing areas around medical history and what we can learn from medicine in the past and how it may be relevant today. So, Peter, with that sort of introduction, do you want to say a little bit more about your interest in medical history? Because I believe you've written a book.
I have, thank you. And if anybody wants to buy it, it's called Daggers of the Mind. It's out on Amazon, and if you buy it, it'll roughly double the number of sales to date. So yes, I was interested in doing a sort of a whodunit set in a mental hospital. So I delved into the history of the actual hospital that I set it in, which is somewhere in Bristol, and it was quite fascinating going into the stories of people. So it was actually built as a prisoner of war prison, and that sort of really sets the tone for the austere look of it. And then it became a in the language of the day, a lunatic asylum. And in some ways, the Lunacy Act was a step forward because before that, people had just been sort of looked after on a pretty much ad hoc basis. So at least it formalized it. But Steve, I know you've also looked into the history of things a little bit when you worked in a mental hospital, didn't you?
Yes, I worked in one of those very old establishments that had probably been developed in the 1850s and was at that time termed the lunatic asylum, but became the mental health hospitals as we progressed. And really fascinating, I had the privilege of being able to look into some of the old medical records hidden underneath in the bowels of the hospital, dating back to about 1880 to 1920, some of them with very early pictures of the people who'd been admitted. And the really big thing that struck me was the people that were in hospital at that time, needed care because of their depression or their perceived madness, were in many cases very well described as people that we would now not refer to as specialists at all, certainly not mental health. So people with hypothyroid disease, with pre-tibial myxedema, coarse faces, deep voice, dry skin, loss of hair, and becoming very, very depressed or having myxedema madness along with that. Quite a lot of people with infections. That was well before we had antibiotics. And people who developed syphilis were coming in, or TB meningitis weren't uncommon. So really interesting to think back that the people that we used to assume had mental health problems, many of those nowadays were detected as being infection or endocrine or other medical conditions along with that.
And we'd like to think that that's all long in the past, but actually, if people listen to my podcast on rare but scary mental conditions, I actually list a couple of infections that can still present as psychosis. So it's still in the differential diagnosis today, isn't it?
Yeah, and in a way, it's probably salutary for us to keep thinking about times gone by and how it may relate to now, because often we think we've got all the answers, and we certainly have compared with years ago. But there are lots of instances where we've still got a lot to learn, certainly with mental health.
And I wonder if we're learning from history, if we can draw the conclusion that a lot of things that were previously listed as either due to mental illness or psychosomatic have actually an organic underlying cause. And I think of the time when we all thought that stomach ulcers, for instance, were stress-related.
Yes, it was stress, or it was down to a blood group and it was your family history. And then we worked out that, because I remember very distinctly a patient coming in saying, I don't want any of your H2 and antagonists. I don't need those. They don't work for me. I don't want a proton pump inhibitor. I want an antibiotic. That worked for me last time. Please, can I have it? And
isn't that interesting? Was that before we knew about H. pylori, that this person had found it out
for himself? It was 5 years before, because when he came back, I had a little note that said, given oxytetracycline on request, discuss side effects, profile, etc., believes it works for his indigestion. And when he came back the next time, he deliberately came back to me because we'd had this long discussion. And I said, you're right. We now know that your peptic ulcer that you were describing that got better with the antibiotic is caused by a bacteria. We now have a chance to do things differently. Really important to listen to the patient. My notes sort of stood out as given the treatment, but now realizing how naive we've been over those years.
Fascinating. And it does take time, doesn't it, to shift medical minds. We get these ideas stuck in our head about causation. And when something new comes along, it can take a long time before we give up. I think of that with unnecessary operations, for instance, that have been found to be of no value, but the people will carry on doing them.
Yes, yeah. And we used to do that with things like, you know, arthroscopy is probably a very recent example that's gone on in that sort of zone, where we've virtually stopped doing knee arthroscopy now, despite the fact for probably 25 years it was the investigation and treatment of choice for people with knee pain. And actually, the outcomes we've got are better because either the arthroscopy made no difference, or if there were parts of the cartilage removed and other interventions, it actually accelerated the onset of osteoarthritis. Thankfully, we do the trials.
Absolutely. That's the critical thing, isn't it? Follow the evidence. But interestingly, I mean, I used to teach medical students and we taught them about placebos and how big tablets were more effective placebos than small tablets. Blue were better for sleeping and red was better for pain. An injection was more powerful than a tablet. And an operation was the most powerful placebo of all. So I'm sure a lot of people got better because of the placebo effect.
Yes, and that was true of heart disease as well. There was a American bit of research that showed that if you tied off the internal mammary artery, that's the artery into the breast, the other main tributaries went to the heart. Therefore, you would be diverting heart blood more convincingly to the heart, and that would improve angina. And in the first 20 or 30 cases, that looked to be very much the case, and it was starting to become spread right across the US until someone said, can we do a trial, a randomized trial, and got people to either open a little envelope that said tie artery or leave artery. And then they evaluated afterwards and found there was absolutely no difference. So the power of the clinician doing an operation that they believe is working and the patient believing it's working for them is still important. Do you think there's any point in us using that placebo effect with our patients, or is that now disingenuous and probably not the sort of thing we should do?
I think placebo is incredibly powerful. In fact, when I used to teach and the students were told, well, the hypertension drugs, two-thirds of it is actually placebo and only a third is the medication effect. They said, well, why don't we just make all drugs placebos because they seem to work in most cases and with fewer side effects, except that you do get a nocebo effect, of course, in some cases.
Yes.
But I think that comes back, Steve, to the idea of the therapeutic consultation, where we can add value to something by investing it with authority and confidence. And that can have real-world effects. So I'm a great believer in placebos, so long as we know, we understand that it is a placebo value and don't fool ourselves.
Yeah, so very difficult to be confident about that. And I think it was Paul Little from Southampton who did some research where they randomized clinicians to be either positive about a vague diagnosis or vague about a vague diagnosis, back pain, abdominal pain. And then they gave them medications. And what was really fascinating in that group was that the clinicians who said, you've got a simple low back pain that isn't showing any bad forms, it should probably take 3 to 6 weeks to settle. That was far better than saying, well, you've got back pain, if it's not getting better, come back to me. Certainly if it gets worse or this or that happens. And you can get that sort of concept with the abdominal pain as well, being much more clear about this is okay, this is simple abdominal pain, whatever it was called. They also randomized people to medication or not and found no difference with the medication. It was purely the clinician effect that made that difference. So again, we've got to recognize the power we have when we're seeing our patients in that consultation.
Language is incredibly important, isn't it? We're encouraged to explore the patient's concept of their own disease, but you've got to be very careful with that. And I'm sure you, as I have seen people come back from an outpatient appointment where they said, well, the doctor said, what do you think is wrong with you? And then the patient, the doctor clearly knows, but they're exploring the patient's ideas. But the way they phrase it, it sounds as though they haven't got a clue. And often patients will come back and say, well, yeah, they were rubbish. They're supposed to know, not me. So language is really, really important. We have to be very careful, don't we?
Yeah, and language has always been important in that sort of concept as well, hasn't it? And I'm thinking back to, again, some of those beliefs we've had over time. And it's taken a long time for doctors to stop people smoking and to encourage people to do that. For many years, many doctors themselves were smoking, many nurses and other healthcare professionals in hospital environments. When I started in practice, I had to paint my consulting room and clean it out over a couple of weekends because it just smelled so much of cigarettes that my predecessor had between each patient coming in. And that wasn't that long ago, believe me. I may look wrinkly and old, but it wasn't. And so, again, we're in that situation of having to try to make sure that our interventions make a difference. And give you another quick example about smoking. Remember, people with asthma in the 20s at school being told to have a cigarette at morning and afternoon break, two cigarettes at lunchtime, because people at that stage thought it might stabilize the disease. Now, that was well before inhaled corticosteroids, short-acting beta agonists, and use of adrenaline. And so people were desperately trying to find something that might make a difference. And perhaps it did cause some scarring and some early COPD in that group that fixed the airways without giving problems. But it's not something we'd want to be promoting now.
No, absolutely. And we're talking about history and so on. Coming back to language, when I've read old notes, and particularly from the 19th century and so on, we have been very judgmental of our patients, haven't we?
Yes.
And the smoking is a good example, because it used to be that most doctors smoked, and then suddenly we realized this was a bad idea, and we would then preach it to our patients. And maybe we're in the same situation now with alcohol, I don't know. But do you think there's a way of phrasing things with patients that can change behavior without being judgmental?
Well, certainly from the smoking perception and alcohol, and quite a few other activity-related interventions, very brief advice techniques are really good for that. So I think we've all probably at some point in our careers had a unhappy consultation with a patient where we've told them it's bad to either drink too much or smoke, and we've told them all the reasons why, and they've become more and more grumpy, and we both go out feeling dissatisfied. 8-10 minutes later, the argument has hit a collision at brick wall both sides, and no one's moved and no one feels better. The very brief advice technique is probably 3 to 4 times more effective than the shouting at them. So much better evidence base, and it takes 20 seconds. Do you smoke? The best way to stop is with professional support and the medications we've got available. I can give you information about that now if you want. No, that's fine. Leave it till next time. Done. Most people know they shouldn't drink too much. Most people know they should take more activity if they're not taking enough. Most people know they shouldn't smoke. Very brief advice available. National Center for Smoking Cessation Training, 30-minute module, will revolutionize your ability to give effective smoking cessation advice quickly.
That's great. I think as GPs, we're always looking for something we can do in 20 seconds. And I'd add to that, that in some instances it's helpful to get the patient to come up with what they want to do. So rather than us saying, I think you need to do X, ask them, what do you want to achieve?
Yeah.
Now, it doesn't always work because they don't always want to achieve what you want to achieve. But if you can get them to come up with the answer themselves, then you're in a much better place to be able to help them rather than push them.
And that's probably one of our challenges for the future is how do we as clinicians encourage our patients to be more active, be more healthy in their lifestyles? And I think back, and I don't know what the answers are here, but in the old days, the doctor would tell you what to do and would expect you to do it. And perhaps with some clinicians, that's still the case. If I tell the patient they shouldn't smoke, they shouldn't. But real world, it's hard, isn't it?
It is. I've come across some very old registration cards. I don't know if it would be pre-NHS, but certainly going back a long time, where if the patient doesn't follow the doctor's advice, they can be removed from the list. But those days are thankfully a very long way away now. How do you think we should go in terms of going on that journey with the patient? How much input should we have in terms of how we set the goals, and how much should we go with what the patient wants to achieve?
A really good question. I think it's tricky. I think number one, when I told my children to do their homework or my wife to do something, they didn't always do what I wanted. And I had to be a little bit more smart if I wanted things to happen, and perhaps negotiate and understand and manage that. And I guess that's probably one of those key things, is always remember to listen to what our patients are sending us, our children and our partners. Listen hard, understand, and then work with what you can to get the best outcomes. But how we do that in a time-limited consultation when we don't have a great deal of time is more of a challenge. I do think now when I'm in a consultation, I'm conscious I've got limited time. So I'm often trying to do a touch point. I think you could benefit from a lot of support to help you here. I know someone who can do that, and pass them on to the excellent counsellor, therapist, sports therapist, whatever it might be, a locality. And how do you get around all those sort of hassles and challenges?
I think, firstly, we are taught not to be judgmental, aren't we? So I think giving the patient the idea that you're on their side, that you're there to help them, is really powerful. And then the second thing is something you mentioned earlier, that we've got the power of follow-up. And for instance, if you look at suicide, the single most powerful intervention is to say, I'll see you again in a fortnight's time. Come back and tell me how you are. And I think that's true for any intervention that we know is going to be difficult for the patient, that we will offer to go on that journey with them, we'll encourage them, we'll see them regularly. And I know that's, you know, we're all under huge pressure, aren't we? But I still think that's a very valuable tool. What do you feel, Steve?
I think the same. I think as we draw to the end of this podcast, I think what we've highlighted is really the importance of the clinician, the doctor, the nurse, physio, pharmacist, whoever it may be, in influencing our patients. I think we've also highlighted that perhaps we don't know everything yet. Perhaps we don't know how good are many of the blood tests we have, how specific are some of the imaging we get at the moment. I know that we've had talks before about how many people have MRI changes on in their spine and their shoulders and knees without any symptoms at all. We're still in a very much a learning phase, and I don't think we should forget that. I guess the other things I look back in history is I'm glad that I'm not prescribing a kilogram of raw liver a day for someone with a vitamin B12 deficiency, because that seems cruel at best, was ineffective, but at least at that point, looking back at what our colleagues were doing, they'd worked out that liver was quite high in B12. The fact they needed to inject it was a few years away, but it does sort of reflect on the fact that we are still learning. We shouldn't pretend we know it all, and we hopefully will keep improving. Peter, do you have any final thoughts before I close the podcast?
I think those are very wise words, Steve, and I'm I'm sure, you know, you and I are young enough that we'll be doing this another 50 years' time. And I'm sure when we come back in 50 years' time, there are a lot of things that we do now that will seem the equivalent of feeding raw liver to our patients. But as you say, the important thing is we look at the evidence, we are willing to change, adapt, use our authority as doctors to help our patients, but not get carried away with that by thinking that we know all the answers, because we certainly don't.
And with that thought of raw liver and probably one of the television programs that seems to offer strange things to eat or drink, I think we should leave you there. Thank you all for listening. Hope you found this podcast helpful and just challenging thinking a little bit about where we are in healthcare at the moment, but the importance of us as individuals. Please make sure to register on the Chronic Conditions website so you can listen to other podcasts in the series, many of which are much more focused on clinical aspects that we're undertaking every day at the moment. And for our interactive webcasts brought to you as part of Chronic Conditions Month 2023. You can sign up to chronicconditions.co.uk. So thank you very much from me, Steve Holmes, and
me, Peter Bagshaw, and get us out of here.
Thank you very much.